A lot of fours and sixes and threes and eights and, you know.
Yeah, and they're not recognized. We're the eights. We're the twos. This movie is for you. And how do you come to any grand conclusions? Which is not to say that there's anything wrong with coming to any grand conclusions, certainly. Some Seinfeldian ethics there. But, you know, I think... there hadn't been a movie that I found in the aisles of the video store, which I was certainly looking for, that represented those numbers.
What sort of feedback are you getting from audiences?
They seem to love it. People in my generation have written me and come forward and thanked me for making a film that they said was real. And someone recently told me that they felt like the film was a coming-in film as opposed to a coming-out film. And that certainly struck me, because I think that's what I was trying to do in terms of a film about self-realization, or getting to a point where you can begin to self-realize.
How long did the film take? It was a long journey?
A bit, yeah. 2 years of steadily writing and 2 weeks of shooting. And, you know, certainly took a few months to get it off the ground, to find people to help to get it moving, for sure.
What was the hardest part?
Knowing when to say, I'm going to go make this movie now. It's enough writing. It's enough listening to people saying you can't make a movie. That moment of convincing yourself that you are going to take that next step, that you are in pre-production, I think is a challenge. Yeah.
I think you make the film, honestly. I think your performance is really what I took away as like the strongest thing. But being the writer, the producer, the star, was there ever a moment where you were like, God, I want to just be nice. Maybe I just suck.
Yeah. Everyone, like our DP, Aaron Torres, you know, people weren't afraid to give me advice. I remember Ben Atkinson, who was our script supervisor. We had only three takes to do the car scene with Maddie. And I played the first two takes a little too light, a little too late in John's journey, I guess you could say. And he said, look, man, I never really say anything, but I really think John's not there yet. Maybe you can take it down for this third one. And I gave it a shot, and that is the take, for the most part, that we used throughout that whole scene. So it was definitely a difficult... I forgot your question. A difficult...
Everyone does.
Sorry.
Where do you fall on the Kinsey scale?
I fell off. It really depends. Most of the time, I just like to consider myself in the middle. I tend to date girls, but it's a day-to-day thing, man.
What do you want audiences to take away from this?
That sexuality is not black and white.
This has been a conversation with Jesse Rosen, writer, director, producer, and now movie star. The Art of Being Straight is a Regent release. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
You like boys, but you don't understand. You like girls, well, give yourself a big hand. You go down, then you come back around. Uh-oh, uh-oh, which way do you go? Uh-oh, uh-oh, which way do you go?
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Michael Laboe, John Torres, Rex Walkner with Phil Kelly, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Free Speech Radio News and reporter Karen Miller. Paxton performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KRCC, Colorado Springs, Colorado, 2ECR, Eden, New South Wales, Grateful Dread Radio, Baltimore, Maryland, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You are listening to WPKN 89.5 Bridgeport and WPKM 88.7 Montauk.
This is WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 and 89.5 FM. My name is Scott Harris, inviting you to stay tuned next for Counterpoint. And back from a couple of weeks away, a lot of catching up to do. We have a number of guests to fill the bill this evening, so I hope you will stay tuned. And we'll be back at you in just a couple of minutes here on WPKN.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serves its own needs. Dummies serve your own needs. Beat it up and not speak. Grunt no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down. High choir and a fire. Representatives have engaged in a government for hire and a combat site. Met the West are coming in a hurry with the furious breathing down. Reporters battle Trump, Kevin Kraft, look at that, no pain, fine, then, uh-oh, overflow, population common, do what it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, whoa, trust your own needs, listen to your heartbeat, tell me what direction is the reverend and the right, right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, right, my feeling, pretty sight,
it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world.
Cotton board, tower, slice and burn, return. Listen to yourself, churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive, incinerate. Light a candle, light a motor, step down, step down. Watch a heel, crush, crush, uh-oh. This means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear. Turn them in, a turn them in, a turn them in of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
This is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here Monday evenings between 8 and 10 p.m., and I'm glad to be back here with you after a couple of weeks' absence. I want to thank my friend and colleague, Ibang Udoma, for filling in these past two Monday evenings while I was away, and I'll maybe say a few words about what I was doing on my trip a little later in the program. But, of course, in the last 2 weeks, a lot of things have been going on. Of course, the Iranian election has seen a dispute about the results there, a violent dispute that we're going to be talking about in just a moment. We had a coup take place in Honduras over the last couple of days. There's been some movement on health care issues in the Congress, which we'll be dealing with tonight. And a flawed climate bill has passed the House of Representatives, and something we've talked about in recent weeks before I took off, and we'll be talking about that again in future weeks. And of course, the deaths of Michael Jackson, Ed McMahon, Farrah Fawcett, and the milestone lives they've led. But tonight, of course, as always, we'll be focusing on different views and perspectives on these current issues. Tonight we're going to be talking about the aftermath of the Iranian election in just a moment. We'll also be discussing a critical assessment of the what's described here by author John Wasik as the unsustainable American dream of single home ownership. A little later tonight we'll be hearing from a representative of the California Nurses Association on the topic of the progressive view of health care reform, namely single payer. Jerry Jenkins will be here later tonight to talk about that. And we're going to be taking a look at the U.S. and world economic crisis with Al Campbell, professor of economics at the University of Utah and a member of the Union for Radical Political Economics. And but right now, as we begin the program, I want to welcome to the show Arang Keshavarzian. He's an associate professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University, where he teaches courses on political economy and Iranian history. He's the author of the book Bazaar and State in Iran, The Politics of the Iran Marketplace. Arang, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So I've been away a couple of weeks, as I mentioned here at the outset, and I've been trying to follow what's been going on, although I was in the wilderness at times camping out. The aftermath of the Iranian election has been violent, to say the least. 17 people have been reportedly killed protesting the election results, where incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was declared the winner over former Prime Minister Mir Hussein Mousavi by a 2-1 margin. Obviously, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people dissatisfied with that declaration of victory by incumbent President Ahmadinejad. And I wonder, as you take a look at the current government crackdown and the violence that ensued in the descent of this election, Arang, what can you tell us now about the state of dissent on the street?
Well, obviously the violence that we've all witnessed is dramatic. It surprised many ordinary Iranians as well as Iran experts who. Of course, Iran is an authoritarian regime, but it's a complex, pluralistic society which has opportunities to express itself. So one thing that's it's kind of odd is that you have a relatively free and fair campaign with 85% participation. This is the official statement, and no one disputes that one aspect of the results. Followed by extreme suppression of citizen participation and dissent. Having said that, it is also noteworthy that much of the protests, especially the first week after the results were released, after the June 12th elections, were extremely peaceful. There are enormous protests. Some of the rallies have been, some of the estimates are up around 2 million. People participated in some of the demonstrations on Monday, for instance, the Monday after the elections. The violence and the deaths have to be put in context of massive demonstrations that were incredibly peaceful, and the government, at least in the first week or so, allowed or kind of stood by and watched during the day, during the demonstrations. A lot of the violence took place at night after the protesters, the ralliers, went back to their homes.
The Iranian government, Arang, the Iranian government has often stated in the ensuing protests, the ensuing protests have been triggered by foreign instigation. Is there any credence to that Iranian charge, in your view?
No, there's very little support for that that point of view. If by instigated by foreign press they mean that there, you know, international press, you know, BBC, CNN has reported on it, well, that's of course true, but it doesn't mean that hundreds of thousands of Iranians are willing to put their put their lives on the line because of news reports from international sources. That is quite disingenuous. And what's important to remember is that these protests that we witnessed after the elections were built on series of factors that emerged before the election, Dave himself, that in a sense facilitated and enabled these protesters to take to the streets. So let me, if you don't mind, take a step back and look at the campaign period. What's important here is most observers and ordinary Iranians thought that Ahmadinejad would win, not because he was hugely popular. In fact, there was lots of evidence that there were disagreements with his policies, both amongst people, ordinary people, as well as some of his closest advisors were increasingly critical during his first term in office. However, most people thought he would win because the expectation was that the turnout would be relatively low, 55%, 60%, and he does enjoy a core, a large support amongst the core constituency, which people estimate to be somewhere between 10 and 15 million. And in that scenario, with the low turnout, that 10 and 15 million, what people expected would translate into a victory. Victory. However, what happened in the campaign caught many people off guard. One was, and there were two factors involved in this. First, there was, for the first time, televised debates amongst all the candidates. And in these debates, there were very vociferous, serious debates taking place. But what was most important, in my opinion, was that it illustrated to many Iranians that the establishment, the core establishment, had deep divisions amongst themselves, and therefore their vote in this election really was meaningful because that these candidates were not all the same. There were real profound differences of opinion in terms of policy, concrete policies, to the whole perspective and view towards politics and the relationship between citizens and the state. And I added to that also foreign policy. So the disputes were quite meaningful. And this, I think, encouraged many Iranians that probably weren't going to vote to actually consider voting and eventually to vote. Added to that was the rather impressive ability of the Mousavi campaign to mobilize the energy and the enthusiasm and the volunteer spirit of many young Iranians who organized what were called the Green Wave, the Green Chains. These were massive rallies the week before the election, which really got people out into the streets and also illustrated to many Iranians who were apathetic and probably were not considering voting to actually imagine Mousavi as a potential viable candidate who could defeat Ahmadinejad. And this also contributed to the large number of people that went to the polling booths on Friday, June 12th. Let me just add here, end here by saying that I was actually in Iran from May 28th to June 15th, so I was lucky enough to witness and participate in the build-up to the election, to be in Iran during Election Day, and also I was there for the first 3 days after the election.
Aran Keshavarzian is our guest tonight. He is Associate Professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University. As he just said, he was an eyewitness to the campaigning in Iran from May 28th to June 15th. Aran, has Mousavi, the candidate, has former Prime Minister Mousavi delivered on his allegations that there was fraud here in this election that prevented him from being declared the winner?
Yes, I mean, along with it, should be said, the other two opposition candidates, Mehdi Karabi, who's a former Speaker of the House, and Mohsen Rezaei, who is a former head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. So these are all three kind of major players in the Islamic Republic at the very outset. These are not kind of marginal fringe dissidents. at all these major players, all three of them from the very outset alleged irregularities, both in terms of the procedures for the campaign, but also on the election day, and then subsequently the actual counting and the releasing of the results. And all three candidates have pretty consistently, Mossad and Kaby more forthrightly, argued and suggested that the violations of the laws, let alone the actual results, require the government to take a deep look at these election results. And in fact, Karubi and Mousavi have both called for a complete cancellation of the results and a whole new election to take place. They have, for instance, have said they would not accept a recount. Now, should be said at the last few days, the government or the Guardian Council has allowed for a recount of 10% of the ballot boxes, which is far less than the Mousavi and Carib campaign would accept, and ultimately that recount can't really change the results.
Arang, I also wanted to ask you about the role of former Iranian President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who was a bitter rival of incumbent President Ahmadinejad in this election and was very vocally opposed to Ahmadinejad's re-election.
That's true. And this actually goes back to the previous election in 2005, when in the second round, in the runoff, it was Ahmadinejad versus Hashemi Rafsanjani, and Ahmadinejad won by a substantial margin. He won about 17 million votes in the second round. And so the conflict, the disagreements between these two important figures goes back. Now, Hashemi Rafsanjani doesn't hold any elected office. However, he does hold important he's the head of two important councils, the Council of Experts and the Expediency Council. So he has institutional power in the Islamic Republic. And besides that, he is considered by many as alongside of the Supreme Leader as one of the kind of pillars of the regime. He is a close associate of Khomeini. He's very powerful from the very first day of the Islamic Revolution. Now, Hashemi Rafsanjani was not in this election, this election that we just had. However, the Ahmadinejad campaign very much ran as if he was in the election. So throughout the debates in his campaign, Ahmadinejad's argument was that he represents a radical break from the previous of rule, which for him is represented by corruption, nepotism and personalism, and is embodied in Hashemi Rafsanjani and his family, enormous wealth, personal wealth, and corruption. So he, even though he wasn't in the campaign, for instance, in the debates, he continuously talked about Rafsanjani and the corruption in his family. He was directly involved. And now, since the election results have come out and the disputes have arisen, behind the scenes, it seems as if Hashemi Rafsanjani, the former president and current head of the Expediency Council and Assembly of Experts, he's the one that, behind closed doors, has been, in a sense, representing the Mousavi and the protesters' camp and trying to argue and leverage his power against the Supreme Leader to get some sort of compromise agreement.
With the crackdown by the Revolutionary Guards and other loyalists to Ahmadinejad, Arang, has the opposition been silenced here effectively, or does organizing continue? Is this likely to blow up at another time and place?
I suspect that even if these protests fizzle out and apathy sets in, this is only the beginning of a long series of confrontations between citizens interested in expanding the sphere of the Republican institutions, the accountable institutions of the government, and factions within the regime who want to maintain a kind of a more closed a system. And I'm talking about the Khomeini-Ahmadinejad alliance. And reason to think that these disputes are not just, it's one thing for the Ahmadinejad and the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Basij and the Supreme Leader to break up protests, to arrest journalists and academics, to use intimidation and fear to control the streets. It's a completely other thing to actually run a government, especially one that is as complex and large as the Iranian government and a population of 70 million people. So the real predicament of Ahmadinejad is how is he going to reconcile a large number of the establishment who have been turned off by his kind of aggressive attitudes towards Hashemi Rafsanjani, towards Mousavi, and many of the leaders of the first three decades. You, in your intro, you mentioned that Honduras experienced a coup d'etat. Well, in the Iranian case, the Mousavi supporters are describing the events of the last 2 weeks as an electoral coup d'etat. And the question is, if this really is a coup, and we have indication that Ahmadinejad is really trying to expunge and expel large portions of the bureaucratic, technocratic class that were associated with previous presidencies, the question is, how are they going to be replaced? Will they be able to be replaced? And if they're not, what are the consequences, and how will this government, what will this government and its policy look like in the coming months, when it's given that it faces popular dissent as well as kind of bureaucratic governmental dissent as well?
President Barack Obama has offered a cautious reaction to the Iranian election protests. How best, in your view, can the world support Iranian citizens who are demanding a full investigation of the charges of election fraud made by Mousavi and his supporters?
I think that the Obama response overall has been a sound one. I mean, given the history, as he very nicely put it, the history of U.S.-Iran relations, it's very difficult for a U.S. president to talk about domestic Iranian politics. And this really is a domestic Iranian dispute. Given the events of the coup of 1953, given the close association, very close association with the U.S. government and the Shah's regime before 1979, it's really difficult for the U.S. to, quote-unquote, make any statement stronger than Obama has. Having said that, I think he's come out quite nicely and consistently, especially over the last week, condemning the use of violence, condemning the suppression of citizen participation and peaceful protests. That's important. Obama's in a very difficult situation because he's come to power with a mandate or with the desire to improve U.S. and Iran relations, and lo and behold, now he's faced with a situation where the whole regime, the whole regime's legitimacy is under question by its own people. So I don't envy his advisors in terms of what the U.S. should do in this context, because any gesture of rapprochement between the U.S. and Iran at this moment is highly problematic, given that this government, it's both its handling of the actual election and its aftermath are deeply problematic.
Arang Keshavarzian is our guest, Associate Professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University. He's the author of Bazaar and State in Iran, The Politics of the Iranian Marketplace. Arang, I wanted to ask you this. With some of the most profound protest against the Islamic Republic since the 1979 revolution, are the protests here an expression, a narrow expression against these election results, or a more profound opposition to the repressive nature of the Iranian theocratic state?
I mean, that's a very important question and a somewhat difficult one to answer, because the large scale of the protests, make it hard to say that, well, those hundreds of thousands of Iranians have taken to the streets, some of them are there, as they say, they're basically there for the issue of, what happened to my vote? Where is my vote? What happened to my vote? And it's really, it revolves around this issue of political rights and civil rights. And I think that's the common theme. Now, there's probably is an element or factions within this movement or these protesters that are would like to see a more radical departure from the Islamic Republic. That probably is the case. And we have to kind of gauge and watch how these protests evolve and change over time. They may possibly take a more anti-regime a turn, but at this moment, I think that's an exaggeration. People were talking about these events as a revolution or the beginning of a revolution. I think are jumping the gun a bit.
But you're fairly confident the opposition and the organizing behind the scenes and despite the repression will continue, and we haven't seen the last of the protests here in Iran.
Yes, I mean, I think it's clear that mass street rallies and protests can't survive in the current violent context. And it has to be, you know, once you give some credit to the organizers that, you know, once they realize that the oppression and the suppression is at this level, they, in large part, kind of called off or rolled back some of these protests, realizing that basically sending these young, but not all, you know, young Iranians out, you're basically sending them out to be beaten or arrested or even worse. So I think they kind of pulled back, and now the discussion really is of devising alternative methods of civil disobedience and protest. High up on that list are attempts and discussions of creating strikes, national strikes, as well as more localized strikes. That's somewhat difficult to do in the Iranian context. Independent unions are weak. The government has used kind of carrots and sticks to control and manage workers' politics, workers' activism. But that's one area that people are looking at. But my view is that, you know, these protests will emerge in different ways at different moments. And especially in the context where the price of oil is relatively low, the government won't have access to large revenue to basically co-opt and buy off dissent. So in the coming months, these protests will probably evolve and morph into other forms of disputes between groups in society and policymakers and Ahmadinejad's government.
Well, Orang, I want to thank you very much for being here with us tonight. And would you like to suggest to our listeners any websites or publications that are covering the events in Iran in a way that would be illuminating?
Sure, thank you. I mean, I'm going to make a little plug for Middle East Report, which is an independent journal magazine that's been covering the Middle East for over 30 years. I must say that I'm on the editorial committee of it, but we did have a special issue that just came out 2-3 months ago on Iran. It was called 30 Iranian Revolution at 30, and many of the articles, including an article about the Basij, for instance, are extremely enlightening. I don't want to say they foreshadow these events, but they provide deep analysis that may help one make sense of these events. And you can go to Middle East Report at www.merip.org, so merips.org, and there are various articles, including an article that I recently wrote a couple days ago about the election and the events. I actually co-authored it. It was available on the website, too.
Okay, yeah, that's Merip, MERIP, Middle East Report, MERIP.org. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, all right. Thanks again for being here with us tonight. Hope we can call upon you again, and glad you're safe back from Iran, and we'll certainly be keeping tabs of the story there.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Orang. I'll talk again soon, I hope. Bye-bye. Orang Keshavarzian, Associate Professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University, where he teaches courses on political economy and Iranian history. It's 8:32 p.m., and this is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, back from a couple of weeks. Again, thanks to Abang Udoma for filling in the last couple of Mondays. And we're going to take a musical break, and we'll be back with a discussion of a new book titled The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a little bit.
to the west. One love, people never gonna stop. One to the sun, one to the morning, one to the one. One to the air and the freshness we breathe in. One to the force of the change in the seasons. One to the mother from which all things come. One to the daughters and one to the sons. One to the father who helps us believe that nothing's ever gonna harm you, seeing. One to the soldier who walks city swamps in. One to the soldier who fights over seasons. One to the man who gets down on his knees and prays for guidance and protection. Keeping. To the east, to the west. One to the culture from the time when it began. One to destruction, one to birth. One to the people who still fight for the earth. One to the people who suffer for the needs. And one to the rebels who love rocking to the beats. And one to the healer who fights the disease. And one to the Lorax who speaks for the trees. There's no amount of money and no amount of man can bring back to life what's gone when it's done. And one to the people who rise with the sun. And one to the people who sleep when it's gone. To the east, to the west. Life is too short to make just one decision. Music too large for just one station. Love is too big for just one nation. And God is too big for just one religion. One through the practice of being in the flow. And one through the tears of the things we let go. And one through the moment we live in right now. And one through the east, west, north, and south. To the east, to the west. To the north and south. To the east, to the west. One love, people never gonna stop.
Never gonna stop.
To the east, to the west.
To the east, to the west.
To the north and south. To the east, to the west. One love, people never gonna stop.
This whole thing seems upside down. But the whole wide world keeps turning around.
The
whole thing seems upside down. But the whole wide world keeps turning around.
On your rockin' shoes and show us your cans. It's a benefit concert for WPKN and a food drive for Strangers Helping Strangers. Friday, July 10th at the Acoustic Cafe featuring the Juicy Grapes.
Isn't that the way love is meant to be? Hand in hand so easily. Well, it takes some work.
It's Friday, July 10th at the Acoustic Cafe. Admission is $5. The Acoustic Cafe is at 2926 Fairfield Avenue in the Black Rock section of Bridgeport. Please bring a non-perishable food item for Strangers Helping Strangers. Save the date, and I hope to see you there.
Set us free.
Johnny, honey, be careful.
It's my record.
Do you care about records? Here's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to show that love. Listener-supported WPKN is in pressing need of housing for our unique record collection. 10,000 of our much-loved albums here at WPKN need a temporary home. Our record library is bursting at the seams. There's just no more room, and that's where you come in, dear listener. Do you have a room, a building that's empty, a studio, a storage space, a really big closet? Please contact Peter Beauchamp, General Manager, WPKN, at 203-331-9756 or email mixedup@pipeline.com. Our vinyl needs you.
WPKN has long been a favorite haven for artists and craftspeople who listen to the station while they work in their studios all day or night. And this talented group has helped the station in the past by donating the fruits of their creativity to several successful benefit art auctions and sales. Now we're looking to do it again with WPKN Art Fest 2009, which will take place during New Haven's annual Open Studios event, hosted by ArtSpace and being held this year on October 3rd and 4th. WPKN Art Fest will be held at Erector Square, a highly popular Open Studios venue. Right now, we're sending out a call for artists. If you would be interested in donating one of your artworks to this benefit sale, please send an email to wpcanartfest@earthlink.net. Describe the kind of work you do or even send an image if possible. One work from each artist will be sold to benefit the radio station, and we hope to turn this into a fun weekend with music and live broadcasts from the site. Please indicate as well if you would be willing to volunteer some of your time to help out during the event. Again, to indicate your interest in being part of WPKN Art Fest 2009, please send an email to wpknartfest@earthlink.net. And thanks.
Well, sorry for that brief pause there. We had a number of messages of upcoming events and needs of this listener-supported radio station. So that was an important timeout for that. And we've been unable to reach our author, John Wasik, to discuss his book, as I mentioned just a moment ago, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome. So chances are we're going to miss him tonight and won't be able to address that issue of the unsustainable American dream of expensive single home housing. But on the other hand, I'm going to take a call here. You hear that? Maybe that's John Wasik calling me now. So let me see if I can just take one more brief message here and get back to you here, and let's see if we've got him. It may be that we won't, and in that case, I'm going to tell you about a little a bunch of adventures I had in a conference I attended while I was out on the West Coast this past couple of weeks, which kind of ties into John Wasik's book. But let's take a listen to this promo for, I believe it's an upcoming event. There's no date on this, so forgive me if this is outdated. But we're going to give it a try, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Frank Carrillo from Frank Carrillo and the Bandoleros, and you're listening to WPKN 89.5 Bridgeport and WPKM 88.7 Montauk, listeners-supported community radio.
Like to relax and chill while listening to some of the smoothest ambient dance grooves on the planet, tune into Lounge Sounds with myself, Jose Colon, and my co-host, Eddie G, every Thursday night into Friday morning from 2 to 6 a.m. on WPKN and WPKM
And if you want more information on Loud Sounds, check out our official website at colonestudios.com. That's C-O-L-O-N, studios, all one word, .com. And also check us out on Facebook. Join our Loud Sounds group today, all from your listener-supported community radio station, 89.5 WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 WPKM Montauk, and streaming worldwide at WPKN.org.
Again, sorry for some of the interruptions here. I've been trying to negotiate this interview here with John Wasik about the book, but several calls back and forth to a number of people have resulted in nothing. So we're going to continue on here. And it'll give us an opportunity to take a few of your calls, too. But I wanted, first of all, just to let you know a little bit about what we were doing over the last couple of weeks. I had actually gone out to the West Coast with my wife, and we had done some camping along the Oregon coast in the Redwood Forests of Northern California, and a beautiful trip through you know, incredible country in northern Washington, particularly the Olympic National Park Peninsula with Mount Olympus and a rainforest, the Hoh Rainforest, and a number of other incredible things I'd never seen in my life, and I was very thankful I got to do it. And certainly camping among the redwoods was a huge, huge awakening about the power and majesty of nature. One of the things I also got to do in terms of taking a look at nature, as much as it's endangered in many places, was I got to go off on a boat off of Washington State's San Juan Islands to take a look at the orcas, the killer whales that you all know from the Free Willy movie and lots of other sort of cartoon images of the orcas or killer whales, and got to see a pod of orcas swimming freely and feeding on the salmon which run along the islands of the San Juan area up there, and incredible animals. I mean, just these huge, 500-ton animals, just amazing, full of grace, jumping and splashing, and totally sort of not oblivious, but really not all that concerned about the boats that are watching them, and certainly the boats keep their distance, but the incredible lives of these animals, which learned a little bit about on this trip, was just flooring in terms of some of these animals live to 98 years old. The calves, which are born, stay with their mothers until their mothers die. These pods stick together. They have their own unique languages. I could go on, and I won't get into all this, but many of you, of course, are familiar with the incredible lives of the orcas. But the last thing I just want to mention to you briefly here was a very interesting conference that I attended with my wife, Anna, and we went to what was called the co-housing conference in Seattle, Washington. And now this was to be somewhat of a tie-in to my discussion with John Wasik, again, author of Cul-de-Sac, who we miss being on air with right now. But co-housing, as many of you will know, is sort of an up-and-coming way of people organizing their living space in cooperative new cooperative models. And what I mean by that is co-housing, as it's practiced among 117 communities or thereabouts around the United States, has some central principles. And we'll be doing some future programs on this. But among the sort of three notable principles are one where people get together and they design and make joint decisions on designing a living space that most closely resemble condominiums, you know, where you have sort of dense housing with everybody having their own unit, their own kitchens, their own living rooms, their own bedrooms, but they are designed in such a way as to foster community, where all the sort of kitchen windows look out on a central square or commons. And there's also a common house that's reserved for community activities. There's also workshops that are designed for people to sort of share tools and other things. There's a lot of cooperation and sharing of resources. And, of course, these buildings are generally designed with green materials and energy efficiency in mind to minimize the carbon footprint of these living arrangements. And it was very interesting. I got to tour one of these co-housing projects in Portland, Oregon, and it was quite an eye-opener. The other major feature of these co-housing projects that I learned about was the decision-making, the consensus process for decision-making, very much like Quaker meetings. And this, again, is designed to foster cooperative living models where people may not always agree on everything, and that would certainly be against human nature if they did. But these living arrangements seem to foster a sense of community and small-town neighborhoods that I think many in the group who form these co-housing projects feel they lost or never had. And, of course, many of you can identify with the idea that you may live in a neighborhood, in a condo complex, in a single home neighborhood, and you may not know any of your neighbors. Maybe you never talk to any of your neighbors. Now, that's not that odd in today's America. But, of course, the design of these co-housing communities is to do just the opposite, is to foster community and people caring and sharing and, living and laughing together, really. I think I met, young mothers and elderly people living together. Intergenerational co-housing projects are the desirable model for a lot of these co-housing projects. And they seem to work, where the young people benefit from the retirees and elderly folks who live there, who have more time and a lot of experience in parenting. And, you have the elderly, of course, benefiting from the energy and the creativity of these young people running around, maybe sometimes driving them crazy. But it was a wonderful thing to get a hold of and understand. And there are some people in our own area here in southern Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, that have formed such co-housing projects successfully, and many more in the works that I know of, even in the New Haven area. So we'll be doing some more on this in future programs. But from the perspective of building community, as well as practicing a lifestyle where energy is conserved, and you design buildings to maximize energy efficiency, seems to be something that has a window of opportunity here right now with the financial as well as the housing crisis that this nation faces. One last note on this, and the keynote speaker that kicked off this conference in Seattle, the co-housing conference, was a gentleman who's an architect and a visionary who put together the first co-housing project that we're aware of in the world in the nation of Denmark. And I'll come up with his name in a minute. I had my notes here in front of me. But he gave a presentation describing the development of the co-housing model in Denmark, which grew from one project, I believe, back in 1962, to now, in the nation of Denmark, where fully one-third of the millions of people who live in Denmark live in co-housing. And it was quite an amazing presentation to understand how this one man and his neighbors got together to form the first co-housing project, and it's blossomed into this model where one-third of the people of a nation now have adopted that model. Anyway, you want more information on co-housing, go to the Co-Housing United States website, which has a lot of great blogs and resources and contact information. Also, some of the recordings that we did will be posted there. And the website is cohousing.org, cohousing, all one word, .org. And we'll be sending some of our photos and such there. It was also the site earlier, before the National Cohousing Conference began, of an international cohousing conference where people from all over the world came to discuss the cohousing model. And back to John Wasik and his cul-de-sac syndrome, turning around the unsustainable American dream. Certainly cohousing, which is not prominently featured in this book, but certainly one of the possible solutions to sort of the growing alienation of people from their neighbors or lack of real neighborhoods, as well as the economic expense, the gross and sometimes unaffordable expense of single home ownership. This very well could be a solution. So we'll be talking about it in future weeks. And as far as the Iranian protests that we talked about with our previous guest, Arang Keshavarzian, I'm just going to mention the website for Middle East Report one more time before we take a musical break, get ready for our next guest. But that website is merip.org, merip.org. And as he said, there was a recent special edition of Middle East Report, MERIP, standing for Middle East Research and Information Project, that was dedicated to Iran. And as he said, some of the articles there really talked about the growing divisions within the Iranian state that certainly were in evidence in this post-election period, with so much dissent and the unfortunate violence in the streets of Iran in these recent weeks. So that's a point of information. And we'll take a musical break here and come back. We're going to be speaking next with Al Campbell, professor of economics at the University of Utah. We're going to be reaching him in Switzerland, where he is now. But he's a member of the Union for Radical Political Economics. And we're going to be talking about a summer conference and retreat that IRPE, as it's known, organizes each year. This year's conference is titled Economic Crises, Opportunities for Radical Change. And that's something we want to know more about. So we'll be talking with Al in just a few minutes. Stay with us. We'll be back.
Hi, this is Frank.
This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. And right now I'd like to welcome to our program Al Campbell. He's a professor of economics at the University of Utah and a member of the group Union for Radical Political Economics and an organizer of this year's annual summer conference and retreat, where the gathering is titled Economic Crises, Opportunities for Radical Change. Al, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
And our listeners should know that in Switzerland, you're about 6 hours ahead of time, ahead of Eastern time, so you've stayed up extra late to be with us, so I appreciate that very much.
Sure.
Okay. Well, Al, tell our listeners a bit about URPE, the Union for Radical Political Economics.
Well, URPE was formed at the very end of the 1960s, during, of course, that period of radicalization in the United States. And the idea was something which is probably even more clear today, that economists in general are trained to be apologists for the status quo. Economics in general, especially what we teach to our undergraduates, tries to make an apology that the system that we have is certainly the best that we can have. And so they have this mechanism that they've developed and that they teach, supply and demand. Supply goes up, and demand comes down, they cross, you get a price and a quantity, and everybody's happy. So URPE formed at that time for radical economists. That means just really people trying to think of some sort of economics that corresponded more to reality, and that makes you a radical in economics.
And this year's conference and retreat, which I've attended, used to take place here in Connecticut at a summer camp up in Litchfield County, and you've moved it now to Pine Bush, New York. It'll be taking place this August 15th through the 18th. But tell our listeners about what the summer conference is all about.
Well, the summer conference, in particular, it is actually the official business meeting for just a short period, but it's we have meetings that we go to, part of the economic profession, where you give professional papers, and those are worthwhile, and people work on different models, and they discuss what's happening. But the summer camp also has formal presentations, but it has workshops. It has things that are a little bit less worked out, a little bit more discussion, and it's set in a context, as you said, at a summer camp where people can get together at meal times, and an awful lot of thinking and interacting and social connections, building social connections occurs in that context. So it makes for a setting in which people can have a lot of discussions in a different format than the 2-hour setting where three people make presentations and then a bunch of people ask questions, which also has value, but this is a little different.
Well, we'll talk maybe in a little bit more detail about some of the workshops and plenary sessions that you're helping to organize for the August conference up in Pine Bush, New York. But I want to ask you sort of a general question here. The United States and, of course, the world has seen an economic upheaval that we haven't seen the likes of since the Great Depression. And a lot of people, certainly got taken to the cleaners with this bad situation, whether it be in housing or the massive layoffs we've seen for manufacturing jobs here in this country and around the world. The economy and people, of course, at the bottom line, have taken a real hit here. Has this episode of calamity here in economics shaken up the orthodoxy at all? We seem to still have in our news media, the predominance of the right and centrist, many neoliberal economics folks yammering at us all the time, questioning stimulus, questioning Keynesianism, questioning what kind of stimulus that Franklin Delano Roosevelt practiced to get out of the Great Depression in the 30s and 40s, and the most left of progressive economists we have, which isn't saying a great deal, is represented by Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Paul Krugman, Pulitzer Prize-winning Rutgers economist. But how do you see the scene in terms of you know how this crisis has affected and shaking up the status quo, the sort of you know what the orthodoxy that everybody adheres to, as you just mentioned a moment ago?
It's interesting. I mean, I guess on that one we'll have to wait just a little bit to see what it's like 5 years from now. The Great Depression did shake up the orthodoxy in the sense that that's when Keynesianism was introduced, though we would argue that Keynesianism quickly became bastardized. It became sort of sterilized of its more progressive elements, the Keynesian synthesis of the or Keynesian compromise of the 1950s really turned it into a much more conservative economics. By conservative economics in particular, I mean the supply side came to dominate. And, you know, once you argue that the supply side determines things, of course, the supply side can't change very fast. Supply has to do with the labor force and the machines that you have, and it denies much of a role for government to make things, to fix things, improve things in the short run. So just last spring, when I was teaching, I actually had two articles, I guess actually both were from the New York Times, and one argued directly that we can expect coming out of this finally to see an end of this orthodoxy, which just doesn't correspond to reality at all. Just 2 or 3 years ago, they were saying everything was going fine and you know, we weren't going to have any serious problems. And then another one that said that finally this upheaval would do something like the 1930s. It would bring in some sort of new paradigm. So we'll have to see. There'll be some changes around the edge, but I think the central message, I mean, the central message of economics is that markets really work well, and that's why Keynesianism, which was not out and out radical, but it had certainly some radical elements in it. And just by saying that the government had an important role to make, the government, then of course you could debate what the government should be doing. Should it be building equality as opposed to allowing the gross inequality that we have in the United States, and so forth and so on. So it's really not very clear. It's they have a very tightly controlled discipline with their journals. People get pushed in a conservative direction in order to advance through their departments. Journals don't publish things if it's very radical, or only a few journals do, and many departments give those journals less credit if you get an article published there. So they have an awful lot of ways of pushing people towards and the question is, again, in the end of the day, will the message be the same? Markets are always best. We should always just trust markets. And that's a little bit what we see right now, is that even people in the Obama government, they're saying, well, we know that we need help temporarily, but the idea is that the markets have screwed up. Let's get in there, fix things up, and get out as quick as we can, because we know that really markets are the best, and some things went wrong, so let's fix it and turn it back over to markets.
Well, one of the things that certainly contributed to this crisis was the Ronald Reagan principles of privatization and deregulation. Of course, they're not invented by Ronald Reagan, but he was certainly the standard bearer for a lot of that those policies coming into office in the election of 1980. But one of the features of the deregulation that we saw on Wall Street was the influence and the power of financial corporate lobbyists on Capitol Hill. These guys had hundreds of millions of dollars to wield around and influence the votes of representatives and senators in Washington that ushered in these devastating moves toward deregulation, which ushered in many important ways this financial crisis. And it seems to me that until we address that, these kinds of calamities are going to repeat over and over again.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I think those are at the heart. Of course, privatization, you know, again, is another code word for no government. Maybe that is another code word for turn everything over to the market. But the deregulation thing, was particularly explosive, and it was particularly explosive when they went beyond deregulating the rest of the economy to deregulating the financial sector, because people that look at it seriously know that the financial sector doesn't work just like the rest of the sector. Even if you're a market fundamentalist, you know, you can argue that, okay, let's let the markets work and some company will go bankrupt and it's doing something wrong and the other companies will pick up the slack. Well, everybody knows that, you know, the banks are all connected. I mean, that's part of our problem. One bank, particularly the big banks, the too big to fail banks, if they go under, it's not just that they go under and the other banks pick up the pieces. When they go under, there's this network. It pulls the rest of the financial industry under with it. Credit freezes, and then the real side of the economy gets affected too. And that's actually a very interesting thing. You know, there's a lot of responses out there, and we could sort of say this very, very quickly. But there's sort of four categories. We could call one a reactionary category. I don't mean to say reactionary, just like use it as a bad word, but they want to really just go back to the way that things were. And we see that in the Republican Party in particular, the extreme right wing. They're actually for just, you know, we saw it in the response speech that the governor of Louisiana gave to Obama's inauguration speech. They want to just let the markets go ahead, do their thing. They know that some people will go under, and they believe so much in markets that everything will be taken care of. The weak companies will get weeded out, sort of this social Darwinian idea, and that'll be good for capitalism. The bankers themselves and Wall Street don't even want that, and most of the capitalist class doesn't want that, because they do know that finance is different. And that takes us to the second group, which is the conservative group, and that's really the people that are in power around Obama, Geithner and Bernanke and all those people. And they believe that there is a role for the government. Markets aren't going to solve it. They want the government to step in, fix things, and then get out again. Of course, it's going to be a huge taxpayer bailout, as it was in the banking crisis in the 1980s. But then the system can go back to making money for the rich. The third group would be the progressive group, and you know, they also want the government to step in. But the big difference between them and the people around Obama is when they want people to step in, they want to make sure that the, you know, Main Street, the small guy, the working guy, gets something out of the process. That we don't. The conservative people want to use the government to sort of restore the status quo that was there before, whereas the progressive people want to use this government stepping in to create something new, create a more just system. But the big difference between the progressives and the radicals, and I must say, and I'll stop with this, but I must say that the IRPE itself is a mixture. It's not, even though the name is the Radical Political Economist, it is definitely a mixture of progressives and radicals. And many people that see doing something progressive now is building towards something more radical in the future, because, of course, we can't just impose something totally radical, a change in the system, because the majority of the Americans don't even want it. The progressives want to use the government intervention, but they want to stay within the box of capitalism, but they want to build a capitalism with a human face, capitalism that's not as vicious towards, sort of as they have the idea, maybe the old Swedish model, not even the new Swedish model, but the old Swedish model where people weren't as brutalized. And then, of course, the radicals are really looking for a system that's fundamentally different than capitalism, and in particular, a system where the working people would not only be treated well, but they'd actually have a voice in controlling how the system worked itself.
We're speaking with Al Campbell, professor of economics at the University of Utah and a member of the Union for Radical Political Economics. And Al, I wanted to ask you about other nations. I guess things are shaking out all over the world in terms of how to meet this economic crisis we're living through. But are there other examples that we here in the United States, around the world, that we could follow or at least take a hard look at in terms of lessons learned, either before or after this crisis, in terms of how some governments and people have reacted?
Yeah, let me just... actually, there's one more thing I wanted to say that you brought up before on deregulation, then I'll quickly say something on other nations. On this deregulation thing, many of these conservatives around Obama, the people like Geithner, for example, are calling for a re-regulation of finance. And some people think that that re-regulation might take us back to the regulation of the type that was undone, the type that was done originally under Roosevelt. I personally think, and there's debate on this, but I personally think that won't happen. I think there will be a re-regulation because finance really destroyed itself in a lot of ways and then went on to destroy the rest of the economy. And so there's discussion all over the capitalist world about how to regulate finance so that it doesn't eat itself up, so it doesn't destroy itself. As you say, by these methods where they really border on the illegal and on the corrupt. They want to get rid of that sort of stuff. But the re-regulation will be such that they hope that finance will remain on top, whereas under Roosevelt, finance really was subordinated to productive capital. You can go back and look at the 1950s. Finance was limited in how much it could charge. Finance was limited in the sorts of things it could do. And that actually served productive capital very well. I don't think that sort of re-regulation is going to reoccur because we don't have that much we have production, but we don't have that much production. We're not a rising power like we were in the 1930s, the productive powerhouse of the world. We know that that's shifting towards China and India and places like that. And so the re-regulation is going to be a new type of regulation that leaves finance on top, the hegemony of finance that people talk about, but it does regulate it to keep it from eating itself up like it did this time. That's just more on that issue that you brought up on deregulation. What about other nations? Well, some people sort of look to Europe because Europe, of course, had a much more of a social democratic system. It had less inequality. It was a less vicious capitalism than United States capitalism. They're not doing anything fundamentally different over there. The governments are behaving very largely the same way, quite often in coordination with the United States. So there's nothing new coming out of there. There's no real return to the post-World War II social democracy. Again, that's, of course, within the frame of capitalism, even, but there's no real return to that going on even in Europe. So you can talk about the radical countries of the world, what's happening in Venezuela, what's happening in places like Cuba, but those are very different social settings than the United States. I personally think that, you know, anybody who's trying to build a better world should look at places like Cuba, Venezuela, see what they do well, see what they don't do well, learn some lessons about what powers people have there that people here don't have, and also what limitations there are there. I definitely think there are other countries to look at, but, you know, we're in a first-world country with the economy that's quite structurally different, and so there's no way that we can look to those things and find a model, a cookbook, a blueprint that we can then bring over and simply slap on the United States. Places to look and learn, but we're going to have to do some inventing here in the United States.
Al Campbell, you know, it's today in the headlines here in the United States, and I'm sure around the world, Bernie Madoff, one of the biggest swindlers of all time, was sentenced to 150 years in prison. He'll certainly spend the rest of his life behind bars. Many of the victims of his scam were you know, I guess, momentarily gratified by that long sentence in jail. But on the other hand, we have seen very little justice meted out to the hundreds or thousands of these top financiers on Wall Street who are responsible for this debacle and the loss of many people's you know, life savings and their dreams for themselves and their families.
Yeah, I'm particularly skeptical that we're going to see much on that. You know, they like to find a sacrificial goat, a fall guy. They like to project the image that it was some bad apples. The system was fundamentally okay. I mean, they are going to do some stuff. The regulation that they're going to put in, again, is intended to, you know, Madoff was bad for them as well as for the average person. And it, you know, lots of people are talking about Madoff was just the tip of the iceberg. There's many other guys out there like that. We're probably not going to hear very much about how far that goes. But it reminds me again, I mean, you think back to, you know, 2001 and the Enron crisis and the WorldCom crisis, and there was all this talk for a while about the need to start putting some reforms in place. Again, this issue of regulation and deregulation, this was now regulation outside of the financial sphere having to do with the boards of governors and, you know, how they did their accounting and what they had to present, et cetera, et cetera. And they talked about it for a year or two, and then the steam went out of it. They passed Sarbanes-Oxley, and within 2 years it was under heavy, heavy attack as being something which restricted U.S. The businesses and put the London people at an advantage and so forth and so on.
Could quickly explain Sarbanes-Oxley to listeners who may not know?
Well, Sarbanes-Oxley, I mean, the important thing about it, without, you know, getting into any of the technical things, is that it did exactly this. Following the accounting scandals, they put in some legislation. Interestingly enough, the very ideas of Sarbanes-Oxley had been put forward over 10 years before, and the group that actually is responsible for coming up with accounting measure reforms is actually under Congress, and Congress actually threatened the group with being disbanded if they continued to push it. And so the thing was set into the background until the catastrophe hit with Enron and everything, and then it was brought out to satisfy people that they were doing something. But, you know, people back then talked about how it wasn't just Enron. There was tons and tons of these accounting profits which weren't real profits. And again, you know, that's what I'm saying. That's what some of the people around Obama that are very interested in capitalism are very worried about, is that capitalists don't even know where to invest their money because they, you know, the companies lie on what they're actually earning, and they hide stuff and they make it so difficult to carry out. So I expect that there will be some more reforms to try to make it so that capitalism can actually function, so capitalists can find out where to put their money to make more money and not get lied to by these people that have just ripped them off as well as everything else. But the nature of the system, you know, as long as you allow these people to accrue this tremendous amount of money, it's pretty inconceivable that anything fundamentally different can happen. Again, for the reason that you pointed out before, if you're a businessman like Enron with lots and lots of money, you know, it's you just make your choice. What makes me more money? Well, maybe I invest in something and maybe I produce some goods, or maybe I take that same money and I buy off some senators and get some laws changed that allow me to make more money. And it's just a economic calculation, which one makes more money. And if I make more money to buy off senators, that's what they do. And that's been making more money now for 20 to 30 years.
And we're seeing that unfold again in another area, in healthcare reform, where you've got Senator Max Baucus, Democrat from Montana, who wouldn't even give a single payer probably the one solution that would save you know, lives and provide health care affordably for everyone in the country. That is off the table, primarily because Max Baucus and a lot of his colleagues up on Capitol Hill, and we're going to talk about this in our next interview, are getting, you know, massive amount of dollars towards their campaign funds from the pharmaceutical companies and the hospital associations and all that, and the doctors. So
that's a very interesting question. Of course, I mean, I totally agree with you. Single payer is by far the most efficient system, and there's just so many studies out there to show it. I mean, it's if you look at it objectively, it's really not a very, you know, you can get lost in the details, and people can throw up a lot of smoke, but when you know, maybe you have to modify this or that here or there, but it's by far the best system. And that brings up the very interesting question, you know, which is a question that takes us back to what I said sort of at the beginning, this difference between reformists, you know, and I think reformists do some absolutely great work in economics, radicals. I mean, one of the questions is, can the capitalist class now in the United States even do what's in its own best interest? Because it's in its own best interest for competitiveness, and they know it, and people like Obama and other people talk about it, that we need a healthcare system. You know, our healthcare system almost is getting to be twice as expensive, and we get no better results than the other advanced industrial countries as a share of our GDP. So we have this tremendous cost, and not only is it a tremendous cost, but it's borne directly by the companies who then have to pass it on through the prices to the consumers, whereas in Europe they have, number one, more efficient systems, but number two, it's actually borne by the taxpayers, so the companies don't have to put it in their prices. So this puts us at a tremendous disadvantage with our competition with the other advanced industrial countries. In their own interests, they should be, the capitalist class of the United States should be looking for the cheapest and most efficient and publicly funded healthcare system. It would also actually be better for the people as well, but it would actually be better for capitalism here in the United States too. And they, as you say, it's very, I mean, we saw what happened when Hillary Clinton brought it up in the early 1990s, how it was just ripped apart. And I mean, times are different. It'll be hard maybe to absolutely 100% kill it in the way that it was killed back then. But boy, they're certainly gutting it. And it's because there's those entrenched interests, the insurance companies, the hospitals, and the pharmaceutical companies, that, you know, they're able to buy off senators. They're able to, you know, there's an awful lot of Democrats that have lined up against this reform because they get so much money from these industries. And that's a sign that a system is in deep trouble when the ruling class, the elite, the powerful can't even get it together to do what's in their own best interest, never mind what might actually be good for society as a whole.
There's one issue I just want to bring up here briefly because I want to have enough time to review some of the highlights of the upcoming IRPE conference in Pine Bush, New York this August. But I wanted to just bring up briefly the question of redefining the rights of corporations as a part of what we should be doing here in this country in reaction to the economic crisis and the deregulation which brought it on. Revoking state-issued corporate charters is a real pet project of a group called the Program on Corporate Law and Democracy, POCLAD. And I know you're familiar with their work.
Yes.
And many of our listeners are also interested in what that's about. But you have any brief comment about that as an avenue for some new thinking about the rights of corporations that this country has for, you know, many, many years accorded these corporations and, you know, really insulating them from accountability in many instances?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, POCLAD has come to the IRPE Summer Conference a number of times and made workshops, presentations of their ideas, and fundamentally, everything they say is absolutely correct. Person status that we give to corporations has, and then of course, you know, we can't even limit what they advertise because it becomes free speech for an individual, and because the corporation becomes an individual. Again, this sort of points the difference between the sort of very, the much more vicious capitalism that we have in the United States and the capitalism that they had in Europe, the social democratic capitalism, which has certainly been chipped away at by neoliberalism, but is certainly still a vastly better social safety net for the people involved than we have in the United States. So, you know, they don't have this personhood for their enterprises, and then, of course, they actually consider it rather bizarre that we do. So what does this personhood really amount to? I mean, it is a piece in allowing the capitalism in the United States to be this more vicious, this more confrontational capitalism, this capitalism that lets a huger part of the population really fall through the cracks. I mean, you know, the standard numbers. You get up to 40 to 50 million and you have all these numbers, people without health insurance, people that are in poverty, people that can't functionally read a newspaper and tell you what they've read. They're functionally illiterate, even though they're technically literate, and, you know, so forth and so on. The personhood for corporations is a piece of that. Certainly getting rid of the personhood for corporations would be a reformist step. It'd be one of a number of things that could make us have a less vicious capitalism. But then again, that's part of the debate. I mean, can you build a capitalism with a human face? I mean, we've seen in the past capitalisms that are less vicious. Can we even go back there? One of the pieces of the arguments was that those more humane capitalisms were only possible because of the world situation after the 50s and the 60s. And capitalism, which is about competition, now has us in competition with India and China. And those are pretty vicious capitalisms. And we're not going to be able to compete with them unless we maintain some sort of vicious capitalism as well. So, yes, the Polk-Vlad people are right. Getting rid of personhoods for corporations would be a good thing. I doubt very much it's going to happen.
Unless we all do something about it, I guess.
Right, right. Now, of course, but if we could do something about that, then the question is, should we stop there, or should we fundamentally nationalize all the productive corporations in the United States and put them under popular democratic control?
Well, that's certainly an important topic to talk about in a future conversation. We're just about out of time, Alan. I want to save a moment or two here to have you run down some of the highlights of the IRPE conference taking place again this August 15th through the 18th in Pine Bush, New York. You got a whole host of topics that will be covered in various workshops and plenary sessions, a lot of it talking about restructuring financial institutions and government regulation, as we've been talking about, but you take on a whole range of other topics, including the international flow of money, the models that are emerging in South America, Venezuela in particular, a review of some of the research on the Great Depression and policies that contributed to the recovery back then. But you want to mention a few highlights for us.
Yeah, and these will become posted further. The IRPE website is www.urpe.org. So it's pretty simple. The plenaries, as you said, and the guests that we usually have one focused lecture have a lot to do with the financial crisis and what that means as far as changes in governance of finance, which is being discussed both by people on the left, but even, as I said before, by people around Obama and people in Europe, because the financial model they had didn't even work for them. One of the things that we always have, so we have some plenaries. We have a plenary session on that, as well as our central lecture on that. We always have a plenary session as well on what grassroots organizing people are doing. So some of these community groups that come out of Boston or Tampa, Florida, or Philadelphia or something like that will come up and talk about what they're doing and how this it's not just a financial crisis, this financial and real economy crisis is affecting them, and of course we know that it's affecting working people and what they're doing about it. So we have all that. And so those are the plenaries, and then, as you say, we give something of a focus to the whole conference. But then, as you say, we talk about all sorts of ideas, both reformist and radical, in economics. And so people in economics do what we do all the time. We work on ideas. We look at places like South America, what's happening. We look at the Middle East and what's happening there. There's discussions, is market socialism a real sort of thing? What about Keynes's ideas in 1941 that were blocked? The role of money, I mean, all sorts of different things, some of them more technical, a lot of them less technical. IRPE itself was set up to be a mixture of community activists and people that were sort of professional economists, with the idea that both groups had something to learn from each other. Professional economists should learn how to talk not in jargon, so that people that are actually doing something progressive with economics, and that usually does not include the government, but people in community groups can actually understand it, and they can use, you know, what expertise we have to help them actually carry out the fights that they have against banks and redlining and housing closing down and exclusion of people from labor markets. And similarly, we can learn a lot from them. It keeps our feet on the ground because, you know, we operate in this world where we read these journal articles that are 99% garbage, 99% defending the status quo. And so it's really great to hear from them the struggles that they're up against and get us thinking about how could economics actually help them as well. So yes, there's the focus of the summer conference, and then beyond that, there's all sorts of panels and workshops on all sorts of economic issues that actually might, either as reformism or as radical structures, try to make a better world.
All right. Well, we're out of time, Al. Thanks so much for joining us, and a special extra thanks for staying up so late to Swiss time, 6 hours ahead. And our listeners can go to your website, URPE, standing for Union of Radical, or Union for Radical Political Economics. That's URPE.org, and they can get information on the Pine Bush New York Conference coming up August 15th through the 18th.
Great.
All right. Thanks again, Al.
Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That was Al Campbell, professor of economics at the University of Utah and a member of IRPE. And it was good to him to check in with us so late in the evening his time. And right now we're going to take a musical break and be back with you in just a moment to talk about health care reform under discussion in Congress. Stay with us. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris, and glad to be back after a couple of weeks' absence, being on the West Coast. And thanks again one last time to my friend, colleague, and WPKN news director, Ibang Udoma, for sitting in for me while I was away. Right now, I'd like to welcome to the program Jerry Jenkins, a registered nurse, co-president of the California Nurses Association and National Nurses Organizing Committee. Jerry, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I wanted you to maybe at the outset here to tell our listeners from your point of view, what are the status of things with health care reform efforts in Congress at this time? We know that there's been a lot of obstacles placed in the path of any substantive discussion of single payer as an option, the system that most of the rest of the industrialized world uses to bring health care to all of their citizens. That has been primarily off the table. We also know that you had provided testimony before the House Education and Labor Committee on June 10th to discuss that, maybe for the first time in this whole process. But again, from your perspective, where are things at right now in Congress?
Well, you know, all the big committee chairs who chair these committees that health care has to get through, health reform has to get through to get to votes, on the Senate side in particular, Max Baucus, have pretty much said single payer is off the table. And people don't feel there's any political way to get that through. And we kind of pushed the issue because we felt that it was rather disingenuous to have a big debate about health care reform and ignore this system that's the most prevalently used system in the industrialized world for providing health care. So during some of his committee hearings, a month or so ago, there were protests by some of the doctors from Physicians for a National Health Plan and some of our nurses. People actually were arrested protesting those committee hearings. And we got a meeting with Max Baucus out of it, and he did say single payer should have probably been a part of the discussion, even though he didn't think it would pass. And in the New York Times, he was quoted as saying, if we had single payer on the table, it wouldn't make the plan that Obama wants with a public option looks so, you know, extreme left-wing, or socialistic, I suppose you might say, how the opponents of these systems are putting it. We think that it's the best way to solve all the issues we have in healthcare reform in terms of cost, accessibility, and, you know, quality of care. And so we support the idea of a single-payer system totally because we think that solves all these problems we're having, where the proposals out there are kind of, you know, putting together kind of a hodgepodge of different things, hoping it works. None of it's ever been tried. You know, we're not sure it'll actually solve the issues, and we know a single-payer system works because it works in every other country in the industrialized world. We were able to get a hearing through Congressman Miller and the Health and Labor and Education Committee in the House, and that was the first single-payer hearing, and it went quite well. But, you know, there's a lot of healthcare industry money being spent to lobby these Congress people as we get down to trying to hammer out some kind of a reform that is going to work to solve our healthcare dilemma. So it's kind of that usual conflict you have in Congress. You know, there's lots of polls to show the American people support the idea of single payer. Up to 60% of Americans support it. 60% of physicians now support it. And we just felt like it was rather disingenuous to keep the single-payer advocates away from the debate and all the discussion that was happening in Congress and in the White House about health care reform. So we keep hammering the agenda and hoping we can push through some reforms that are actually going to work.
What's the architecture of the plan that is the compromise that many of the leaders in Congress and President Barack Obama have signed on to so far? What is it going to look like?
Well, they talk about a public option, but nobody knows exactly what it would be because nobody's given us the hard details of what it's going to be. And there's already this backlash against even something as simple as having a public option that competes with the insurance industry. But so far, we don't have a really good defined definition of what that would be. You know, I was a member of the audience at the ABC News press conference, you know, town hall in the White House last week when people were asking Obama some of these questions. It's all very theoretical, but there's no hard facts out there yet exactly what we're looking at. I don't know if they're waiting to the last minute so there's not time for a big backlash. I mean, we are already seeing a backlash against the public option, even something as basic as that. So we don't really, our concern is a public option, if it's watered down too much, just becomes a dumping ground for the sickest patients, and the insurance industry will find a way to cherry pick the people that are the least sick like they do now, putting those sick people into a public plan that won't have the ability to be the most cost-effective public plan, which, of course, is single-payer. And then you can see the backlash happening. Well, look, we have a public plan. It costs too much. It doesn't work. When the reality is you have to eliminate that for-profit incentive in the delivery of care that the insurance industry promotes, because that takes a third of our health care dollar right there. 30 cents of every health care dollar goes for something other than health care. You know, and it's the profits and the shareholders' dividends and the CEO's wages and the marketing and all those things that don't provide anything in terms of providing a quality standard of care for the people in this country. And we've got 50 million people uninsured. So it's been an interesting experience, you know, trying to you know, get them to look at that, what it is. There's so many misconceptions in the public's mind about what a single-payer system is, too. So we keep trying to educate the public to what it is. We really feel that we need a grassroots movement, people going out and hammering their congressional people and letting them know what they want. You know, that New York Times poll a week ago Sunday was pretty telling, because about 75% of Americans support a public option that would compete with the insurance companies to keep them honest. And even that's meeting resistance. So it's very interesting. There seems to be a disconnect between what Congress thinks they need to do and what the people want, which makes you wonder where that disconnect comes from, you know, especially when the health insurance and the for-profit health industry is lobbying monies up 100-200% over last year at the same time.
Well, I, you know, on that very topic, I was reading earlier today something from the Montana Billings Gazette. They say in the past 6 years, nearly one-fourth of every dime raised by a Montana Democrat, Max Baucus, and his political action committee has come from groups and individuals associated with drug companies, insurers, hospitals,
exactly,
medical supply firms, health service companies, and other health professionals. These donations total about $3.4 million, or $1,500 a day, every day, from January 2003 through 2008.
Right. So he's the third largest recipient in the Senate of health insurance industry money, of health, the health industry money, behind McCain and McConnell. So he's the number one Democratic recipient in the Senate. And, of course, he chairs the Senate Finance Committee, and he came right out, right up front, before there was any debate or discussion about anything, and said single payer is off the table. And, you know, you got to wonder why. You know, it seems pretty obvious, but, you know, it's hard to understand when there's so much public support and it's becoming growing every day, whether it's for single payer or a public option, that these people are arguing that, you know, against it, when they supposedly represent us, not those industries. But, you know, you could argue that's not the case with the way they spend money lobbying in Washington. So,
Jerry,
you know, California, a few years ago, when we were pushing our single payer bill, we actually got an initiative on the ballot for publicly financed elections to get the corporate influence out of the democratic process, and that unfortunately didn't pass, because we kind of felt like to have true meaningful reform, we need to get the big corporate money out of the democratic process, and unfortunately our initiative didn't pass here in California.
Well, I know other states have pursued that, and it is working its way through a number of states, so it's not to lose hope there. But you're right, that's a huge obstacle to meaningful and substantive reform in so many areas in our flawed social and political structure here. But, Jerry, during your testimony before the House Education and Labor Committee on June 10th, you talked about 100,000 lives or more that could be saved if we did have universal health care and afforded people preventive treatment that they're not getting currently. And you told the story of a patient, 17-year-old Nadalene Sarkisian. You want to tell our listeners about her?
Well, she had had leukemia and had chemotherapy and had gone into remission. And when she fell out of remission and got sick again, she had a bone marrow transplant from her brother. That was a successful bone marrow transplant. It had engrafted. She was producing the, you know, the white cells that her body needed. But unfortunately, the chemo had destroyed her liver. And her doctors at the UCLA Mattel Children's Hospital felt like she would be a good candidate for a liver transplant. She was young. They said she had a 65% survival rate at 6 months, and they were all ready to do it. They actually had a liver for her, so it wasn't like she was sitting on a list waiting when this all transpired. She actually had a liver for, they actually had a donor liver for her, but Cigna refused to pay for it because they said it was experimental in her case, even though her doctors presented all kinds of evidence from the medical literature of them doing these kinds of procedures. Like I said, they gave her a 65% chance of survival at 6 months, which is pretty good with transplantation as you go into the survival rates. And, you know, so they basically said to her family, you know, if you want us to do this, it's going to be, it'll cost you $375,000. I mean, how many of us could, like that, pull $375,000 out of the hat to save a family member or a child? So we took to the streets in front of the Cigna offices in Glendale. We had hundreds of people protesting. They finally relented and agreed they'd do the transplant. And I'm telling you, I was there. We were still rallying downstairs when her uncle ran up, grabbed her brother, and said, "Get your parents now." And Natalie was dead 4 hours later. The CEO of Cigna that year made $28 million and got a $3 million bonus. I mean, his bonus would have paid for 10 liver transplants. And this is the whole problem we have with this. Instead of the clinicians, the doctors making the decisions about your health care, you have some bean counter in an insurance office doing it. People talk about rationing of care with a single-payer system. Well, we ration care here every day. We let thousands of people suffer and die or suffer disabilities from lack of care every day, only it's not doctors making decisions. It's insurance companies making decisions. You know, they talk about choice, but, you know, if I have one my insurance through my employer with one insurer and the next year they decide to go to with another one because it's cheaper, my doctor may not be in their plan, and I may be changing doctors all over the place. So the idea you have choice and care isn't rationed in this country now is a myth. And in a single-payer system, you have complete choice. You go to any doctor you want. You know, it's the doctors and the clinicians who make the decisions about your care, not somebody making a decision about, you know, how much money they can make by denying you care. See, the way they make their profits is to deny, restrict access and deny care. And to keep them at the heart of the delivery of care, the for-profit insurance industry and these groups, as we talk about reform, it seems to me as long as they're still in the center of the delivery of the care, it's going to be very hard to contain costs because they're going to get their profits however they may. And it's going to be very hard to create a standard, single standard of care, quality care for everyone. And the bureaucracy involved in these things they're proposing would make single payer look like nothing because you have one system, one set of rules, one bureaucracy instead of 1,300 different bureaucracies, which is what we have now because we have 1,300 different healthcare providers and HMOs and different groups. So all those myths out there that are created around a single payer system that would be government funded but privately administered through doctors and clinics and offices and hospitals. They get global budgets to provide the care they give if you're a big hospital or clinic. You know, they're myths created by these people who love the status quo because they're making a killing off it. And people are dying off it. So, I mean, that's the dilemma we face. And I think the American people are starting to get it. And I think it's a myth to think that people are happy with their insurance. People are thankful they have what they have through their employer. But no one I know who has employer-based insurance doesn't live in fear of losing it or having the copays go up or having the costs get so prohibitive they can't even use it when they have it. You know, there was a study just recently that showed that even with people with insurance in this country are now self-rationing care because the copays and the deductibles are so high, so they're cutting their pills in half, skipping those screening tests the doctor wants them to get because the copays are so cost-prohibitive. And that's people with insurance.
And I think another dimension that too is a lot of people stay in dead-end jobs that they hate because that's the only way they're going to, and they spend decades in these jobs because they have no other choice for health care, and they know health care could spell the difference between life and death if as they get older and you know, potentially get a disease or have an accident.
Well, we always tout this great American entrepreneurial spirit, but that talk about stifling entrepreneurship. If you have some great idea and want to go out and start your own business, but you have an issue with your health, you're not going to be able to do it because you're going to be constrained exactly by those things you talk about. And I'll tell you another aspect of it that is interesting. You know, if there's a mistake made by a doctor or a hospital in a country with a single-payer system, you may sue for pain and suffering. But in this country, not only do you have to sue for pain and suffering, you have to sue for enough money to take care of your health needs for the rest of your life because you'll never get insurance ever again. So it kind of feeds the whole litigation process. If you knew, you know, if something happened to you, but you knew your health care needs were going to be met through whatever crisis it was for the rest of your life, you wouldn't have to sue for $25 million to cover your health care needs because they're covered, you know. So I think it promotes all kinds of things in indirect ways that people don't really think about. And I think it helps fuel these huge settlements and lawsuits because if something happens to you that leaves you disabled for the rest of your life, you need to know you're going to have care for the rest of your life. And once that lawsuit goes into place, you know, you'll never get insurance ever again. So you're just kind of stuck. So I think there's a lot of ways this impacts things in this society that people don't really even think about. We have some of the worst health care indices of any country in the industrialized world. We're 19 out of 19 rock bottom last in preventable deaths, and we spend twice as much money as any other country in the world. And we have some horrible health care outcomes in this country compared to countries that spend way less than we do and have way better results from the money they do spend. So, you know, the time is ripe. I mean, I think everybody is being impacted this directly or indirectly, either themselves or through someone in their family or their friend or a neighbor. So I think we have a whole different climate in this country that's ripe for some kind of significant change. We just have to put the heat to our politicians to have the political courage to step up to the plate and do the right thing.
Jerry Jenkins is our guest tonight on Counterpoint. She's a registered nurse and co-president of the California Nurses Association and National Nurses Organizing Committee. Jerry, just like in the 1990s when Bill and Hillary Clinton were proposing health care reform, the health insurance industry and big pharmaceutical companies have launched a TV ad campaign to prevent health care reform in any meaningful way. And one of those who is a prominent spokesperson of the opponents of health care reform is a guy named Rick Scott, who's former head of Columbia Hospital Corporation of America,
ACA,
a company that actually had been found to commit massive Medicare fraud and was fined like $1.7 billion back in 1997 when Rick Scott was thrown out of his chair and CEO position at Columbia HCA.
His parting gift was $100 million. In stock, so you can kind of see where he wants to maintain the status quo. That's how he's going to make his profits off this publicly traded company, and it's people like that out there promoting this scare tactics about what single payer would be. I've seen some of those ads. In fact, I saw on TV last night that in one of those ads, he has a doctor from Britain bemoaning the British healthcare system. Well, some, reporter tracked him down and put him on the hot seat, and he had to say, 90% of Britons like the national health, and we wouldn't want an American system, but we think there's room for improvement on the American system. And you're like, well, you're doing these ads promoting, trying to discourage people from supporting this system, which is the system similar to what you have in your own country that you say 90% of your citizens support. So I guess the moral of that story is, there's always people out there who will put their face out there to promote something if there's enough of a payback for them in whatever way they get it, I suppose. But, there is a lot of misconception being promoted out there by these people who have big, deep pockets who can spend a lot of money. But I think the American people are just beaten down and worn out by the situations they have to go through every day in their own life. And everybody talks about what happened in 93 with Hillary's plan, but I think we're in a totally different place now in terms of the public's perception of what health insurance companies do, how they act, their own personal experiences with having to self-ration their own care or the cost just escalating out of control, to where I think the public's much more receptive to having a system that's going to work, something like a single-payer system, than the politicians are giving them credit for in some ways. I think I don't think anybody I know who has health care doesn't worry every day they're going to lose it.
Jerry, what's the most effective thing that people listening can do to affect the course of reform debate and eventual hammering out of a bill in Congress?
Well, all those guys, where they really live is at home in their districts with their constituents. So I think we need to go out and lobby our congressmen and lobby our senators and really put the heat on them to know that this is what we want, and make them feel that threat from their constituents and not getting what they need out of them in terms of providing a system that's going to work. I mean, Max Baucus has gotten a little heat of his own in Montana at some of the public forums he's tried to have around health care. And I think that's what we have to do. I mean, I think President Obama's trying to do that by getting out of Washington, out of, outside the Beltway where the real world lives, and pushing his agenda for health care reform outside of Washington, because I think that's where this has to be. It has to be grassroots. It has to be citizens getting together and putting these agendas together and going forward with their local congressional people and making them know that this is what we want, and kind of overriding that corporate voice that's kind of stealing the spotlight in some ways right now.
Jerry, do we know what Barack Obama's bottom line is here? Is he going to step up and use the bully pulpit to make sure that at the very least that there's a public health care option competing with private health insurance when this thing is all over and done?
I don't think we know yet whether he will do that. Now, we got to hope he would do that. And we got what he's got, this high rating of support from the public, and he's got majorities in Congress that could push the agenda. I think he needs to go out and sell it. And, they're kind of playing it close to the vest. Nobody's real sure what the bottom line is. We hear rumblings that, you know, they don't want to tax your health care benefits, but maybe they'll tax people who get really good high-cost Cadillac plans and, you know, things like that. And I don't think we have a good feel for exactly what they're talking about yet and what they're looking at. I mean, some people think the way to cover everyone is to mandate that everybody has to buy insurance. And unless they've done that in Massachusetts. It's failing as we speak. They've tried it over the last 20 years in four or five other states. It just doesn't work. So, there's a lot of things being proposed, but we're not quite sure exactly yet what they're going to be putting forward. But we as an organization really firmly believe that the only thing that's going to solve these problems that we have is a single-payer, publicly funded, privately administered system like Medicare expanded to cover everyone. And we don't really even believe the public option is going to really do the trick as long as you leave the private insurance industry, the for-profit insurance industry out there, you know, in the mix. Because they'll find a way... Trust me, they'll find a way to figure out how to cherry-pick the least sick patients and manipulate the system. And I think the best way to provide the citizens of this country what they really, truly deserve is to have a single-payer system. It's
sure.
Like Paul Krugman in the New York Times said, he wrote an editorial a couple of weeks ago. He said there's two things you have to remember about the insurance industry. Number one, they can't be trusted. Number two, they can't be trusted. And I think that's probably a pretty accurate assumption, you know. So,
Jerry, I just have one last question, but there's a lot of buzzing on the line. I'm not sure you're maybe in a place where you can move from. A lot of electrical current. I'm not sure what's going on. But
well, I had to move out of my living room where my dog was
right.
Barking.
Right. What's the dog's name? He should get proper credit for the barking. What's his name?
What was that?
What's the dog's name? We should give
Molly.
Him proper credit. Molly. Well, thank
I
Molly for us.
I don't want Molly to steal the thunder here.
No, just a last question for you, Jerry. In your view, would a flawed health care reform bill passed through Congress and signed into law be better than no reform at all at this point?
It may be, depending on what it is. It may not solve the problem. And, you know, we do spend more on health care than any country in the world, industrialized world. It's grown and ballooned to where it's 16% of our GNP. Most countries, it's 8%. I heard someone from Canada speaking. They expect their percent of GNP for healthcare which is 8% now, to remain 8% through 2025, where ours is expected to just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And it has the potential to really just create huge economic upheaval in this country, and it could be a huge economic mess. And so it really is an issue that needs to be solved. And you know, if we put a Band-Aid on it and we go 2, 3, 4 years down the road and we're having the same old issues all over again, then we're just going to be farther in the hole as we go forward. So it's hard to say if this is actually going to, if it would be worse than not doing anything at all, you know. So we just got to keep fighting the good fight and pushing the agenda.
All right, Jerry. Well, thank you for all you're doing on this healthcare reform issue in Congress and, you know, in your local organizing. And leave our listeners with your website or any other resources they could tap in to get more information. And
well, we have calnurses.org, and we also have guaranteedhealthcare.org, which is a coalition of groups that work on this, and those are good places to start. And there's also Physicians for a National Health Program, info@PNHP, I think that's .org as well. And so there's resources out there for people to go to.
Okay, that's calnurses.org, guaranteedhealthcare.org, and PNHP, standing for Physicians for National Health Program.org.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right, Jerry. Well, again, thank you for being here tonight, and we'll check in again and take the pulse of what's going on with Congress in this
reform.
Well,
if your lights are flashing, I bet you've got a lot of people ready to comment.
All right. Jerry, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Jerry Jenkins, a registered nurse, co-president of the California Nurses Association and National Nurses Organizing Committee. That's it for our program tonight. JF is up next. Stay tuned. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Thank you all for listening. Visit our website, WPKN.org. Some of the segments heard here are also in edited form on the Between the Lines Radio News Magazine website. That's BTLOnline.org. And go to our website to get podcasts and a lot of other weekly summaries and such. Thank you all for listening, and it's good to be back after a couple of weeks' absence. And I guess we're going to just take a last cut here while JF gets ready to slip in here behind the microphone. Let's see.
Frank Carrillo.
I'm not quite sure where our track is here, but we're going to aim to play it right now. Again, thanks for your toleration for all the technical messes we've tried to patch over here. Stay tuned. JF's up next.